Okay. All right. I'm going to take a seat. It's hot in here, don't you think? Oh. Maybe we could get them to come and give us some air.
You can turn it down. I think that's what we'll do. Four more
seconds. Would you bring your guitar, Errol?
Not lifted from that.
Could you comment on how the waters of Noah are like a type of cross? Your thoughts on that?
That comes, the question was, could I comment on how the waters of Noah were a type of Christ? In fact, let me just go through that just a second.
Type of the cross.
Type of the cross, yes. And it's better first just to read it, okay? Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 54. And this all, like at the top of my Bible, it says prophecy of the Savior. So these are all, this is especially Isaiah 53 and 54, 55, right through there is all prophecies, very poignant prophecies about the Savior and what he would do. And verse 7, if we start there, says, for a small moment I have forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. Now that comment is made reference to about the cross.
Which chapter?
Yes, 54. And looking at verse 7. For a small moment, remember Jesus said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? All right. This is quoted by theologians and people around the world as this was the fulfillment of that when Jesus cried out on the cross. For a small moment I have forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer. For this is as the waters of Noah unto me. Now, why is this like the waters of Noah? What would make the prophet Isaiah, inspired by the word of, by the voice of God, to say that the cross is comparable to the flood? Well, let's read and see why. For this is as the waters of Noah for me. For as I have sworn. So the very first thing that we get to compare is that he's saying, I made a promise out of the waters of Noah. We all know a promise did come out of the waters of Noah, right? For as I have sworn that the waters of Noah would no more go over the earth. All right, so we got the promise that came out of the flood. And since he's comparing this to that moment of being forsaken on the cross and what the result of that would be, he says, so have I sworn that I would not be wroth with thee nor rebuke thee. So the comparison between judgment at the flood, which we're comparing judgments of the whole world, is why they're comparative. And the judgment of the whole world through the flood, there was a promise that came out of that. And we know he says he placed the bow in the sky so that anybody that saw it. I remember I used to read this when I was describing the gospel of peace. The other promise that comes out is that God would not be angry. So holding that comparison closely, I was able to, in 1982, I was able to hold people's attention to this fact. How many people benefited from what the rainbow said? The rainbow says that God would never destroy this planet again with water. Okay? What about atheists? Did atheists benefit from that promise? Yes. What about people who loved God? Yes. Hated God? Belonged to the religion something you disagree with? Do they benefit from it? Every breathing human being benefits from this promise that came out of the flood. So you see, you cannot reduce the veracity of the promise that it's being compared to, because that's part of the reason. In fact, that is the reason it's being compared, is because of the veracity of the promise. He says, for I have sworn that I would not be wroth with thee nor rebuke thee. So who gets the benefit of that? We have a rainbow in the sky that says that God will never be angry, will never flood the earth again with the water. And we have a cross standing on the outskirts of the temple, just outside Jerusalem. And we have the cross standing there that symbolizes that God will never, ever be angry again. He said, I will not be angry or rebuke you. Now, in just the case that we didn't understand, he said, for the mountains shall depart and the hills shall be removed, but my kindness won't depart. So here is where we get a very clear dividing line that Pat Robertson has never read this. Jack Van Impe has never read this. And every time there's an earthquake, every time there's a disaster, they say it's God. Well, God said, you're going to have earthquakes, you're going to have destruction, but he says, but my kindness will not depart from thee, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith the Lord, which hath mercy on thee. So that is the comparison between the flood and the cross. The comparison being, there was a promise, this is the comparisons. Both were judgments for the whole world. Both had a promise come out of them. And one was that promise affects the entire planet, so we cannot reduce the veracity of the second promise to be less effective than the first. It's for the whole earth. All right. Anybody else? Neil.
I was kind of, my question is along the same lines, but I was curious, like, how do we know that God planned to have Jesus come before we even started the world, and it's not, wasn't it kind of an ongoing, something he decided after he had started the world type thing?
That's another line of thought, Neil, and it's one I've held to.
I was curious, even the Bible, and I think my probably was Noah, when God was going to destroy the whole world, and Noah said, we're not all bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I go back to the early, before the flood, there's people running around doing crazy things, rape and pillaging and crazy false gods and such.
Right.
But then God decided he was going to ruin the whole world, and Noah said, well, we're not all bad.
Mm-hmm. And that happened in more than one case, in Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
In that case. And Jonah got God to repent from destroying Nineveh, and which he was none too happy about. The best that I remember, he was kind of disappointed that God didn't do this. But we were doing today was just simply reading what it said, and what Paul said is that this plan was formulated in the mind of God before the foundation of the world. Now, the term world there is cosmos. So we know it's not talking about the age of the law, nor the age that came after the cross. He's talking about the world before the foundation of the world. And I told you about Francois's declaration about us being birthed in the mind of God. The odd thing in us dealing with time and space is that we have a God who has no restrictions of time and space, but everything that he's done within time and space to help us understand what he's doing, because we are restricted, God is not. Now, for there to be a statement that God had this in his mind before, you have to remember that time and space is a non-existent thing in God himself. So when we think linearly, why is that? I can't say the word. Yes. When we think this way, we've got to realize that that line is not inside God. So things have happened simultaneously in the mind of God. These are not things that have occurred on a particular timeline. They happen on a timeline for our understanding, not that they were not God's evident conclusions even before they ever started.
When he changed his mind and didn't destroy
the
whole creation all those times, it kind of looks the same as he was going to destroy all mankind and punish all, but had Christ spared, so to speak, which took us all in. And I wonder if that was kind of a type and shadow to show that there would be a destruction, but it wouldn't be
Exactly. And I think that that is our challenge, is being stuck in time and space. That is our challenge, is to let this be what it is without turning it into a religious pursuit. Let me say this. I don't care. Anybody can tell me, well, I think this, I believe that. I'm quite all right with it. It's not going to change the truth, regardless of whether somebody thinks right or doesn't think right. That doesn't change the truth, and it doesn't affect as to whether or not I'm right or wrong either. So I really am at peace with those things. But when we begin to look at these things, and people say, "Well, I don't believe this, and I don't believe this," this is what I get to. I think this. And the thing I want is, where does it say that? I can go right with you. But where does it say that? Well, I don't think God was ever mad. Well, I can understand why the statement could be made, but show me in the scriptures where it says that this was all an illusion. You know, if it was an illusion. Now, you see, we do have, when we go through this whole thing about the mystery of blindness. Now, if the mystery of blindness is there, why wouldn't the mystery of this was just all an illusion be there? Because that, let me assure you, that is not there. So as a Bible teacher, a person who believes that the scriptures are true, I'm not going to get away from this. Now, my understanding of the scriptures has evolved, and you guys know that, has evolved all of these years as we've gone. I don't have a bone to pick with anybody. I don't need to prove anybody wrong. But when I see a doctrine that causes people grief, I don't want to let that doctrine go unaddressed. You see, it's just like dealing with Buddhism and mysticism. Now, and I have friends that are Buddhist and who are mystics also. But when you get inside of those two religions, which they claim they're not a religion, but when you start seeing the ladder climb and the karma and the retribution and it's do good, get good, do bad, get punished. It's the very same thing that was under the law. Karma is law. And you cannot take that out of there. In fact, with Buddhism, if somebody believes that we have multiple lives, that's quite all right. I don't have a problem with it. But when you realize that it's worse than just dealing with and paying for your lousy little stinking life here on this earth this time, you're going to have to come back as some kind of varmint and redo it all over again because you didn't elevate enough or whatever the terms are. And that's a cycle I don't want to be. Oh my God. Oh, I so hope that ain't true. And the funny thing about it is when people start talking about multiple lives, nobody just used to be a peasant.
Oh, they were all kings.
Everybody was a king and a tut and and a queen and a ruler and a conqueror and and all of these things. And here's the thing is, you don't know that. Now, can somebody believe it? You can believe it, and it's quite all right. I don't care if you were King Tut, and in the next life you're going to be a bug. It's not my decision. But to see, the thing that I think we have to be careful with, we have to decide where do you put your flag is where you get your information. All right? You got to decide that. And maybe you get your information from multiple sources also. You have to understand where I'm concerned that I still am very committed and dedicated to what I believe the scriptures are. And I believe that they are a written down, became a revealed truth about Christ and the cross. I really do believe that. So when I am determining whether or not I can follow a line of thought with somebody, I have to read it in a context rather than anything else. Now, the reason that I was able to bring you into this line of thinking that Neil questioned us about, and that is, and the things that we've kind of seen this in a linear way. And now, why didn't I have no problem with linear that time? I don't know. But we've seen this in a linear way. But we also have chosen not to ignore Paul's great statements here that this was all done before the cosmos. We've made a big deal out of the difference between cosmos and aeon. And I'm not going to make a big deal out of it when it agrees with my theology and then dismiss it when it doesn't agree with my theology. I'm not going to do that. So we find here that before the foundation of the cosmos, something was determined in the mind of God, and it was that we would all be one in Christ. I'm good with that. Do I know exactly how this process has worked out or why there had to be a process? I don't have a clue. But we're learning. Now, here's the thing, folks. Remember, you see, we have been so of a terminal mentality that we feel like we either get it right now or it's never going to be got right. But see, we could be a part of a generation that we get this part right. And the people who come along after us get the next part right. Because look how far we've come in the last 2,000 years in this understanding of the gospel. My goodness, we have come light years, almost in a technological sense, by comparison in understanding the power of the gospel and the all-inclusiveness of the work of the cross. So as we proceed, we are going to continue to think, but the thing that you will not hear me do is change my mind because something sounds right. If you can show me where it says that, then we'll go there. All right? And at least begin to consider it and think about it. Otherwise, it's just not... it's great with me if you think that way, but I have no... But see, here's the thing. If I'm right, you being wrong doesn't change anything about what I teach.
Or the truth.
Yes, if this is the truth, then of course, God still... even in the disagreement, sees us both as righteous and holy and perfect. So that's the point that we come from, that all other religions cannot come from whatsoever. Leslie.
Mike, could you just repeat what Joseph Prince said and the justification that he uses for it? I want to listen to it again.
Yes. That was in 1 Corinthians. Let me tell you what he did. And he did it all in 1 minute. In fact, a little clip on YouTube says, Joseph Prince exposes universal salvation in 1 minute. And so I'll show you. He put both of these verses, a little video clip, you can look it up. And he put both verses on the wall, one on one side of the stage and one on the other. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And that is found over here earlier. This is 1 Corinthians 15:22. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. And then he said, you had to look at this in context. Which I thought was very interesting, that he considered just one more verse context, when the whole chapter 15 teaches on the subject. And he said, you know what you get when you get a text that is not in context. You get a con. Nice little play on words. But a text without context is a pretext, not a con. So, yeah, we know, sometimes we know just enough to be stupid. And just because it's a play on words doesn't make it the truth. And he did do a nice little play on words. So he read this, for as in Adam all die, even so. But no. That doesn't mean all. Who is the all? Who is the all? But every man in his own order, Christ the first fruits, and afterward they are Christ at his coming. So all don't mean all. All means you who are in Christ. Well, he is correct also in that point. But he didn't read the rest of this to see who all is in Christ. So the fact of it is that, and he says that all teaching on what he calls universal salvation comes from this one verse.
Mike, with all due respect, just having you read that again to me confirms what I thought when I first heard it. He's completely contradicting it himself.
Yes.
And, you know, it's rather foolish.
And I understand why Joseph would choose to contradict himself. Because the gospel that Joseph preaches, I've shared with you guys, I taught him that over the phone in 1997, and which he now denies that he has any recollection of who Mike Williams is at all. But we spent many, many hours on the phone together. And if he watched my life when I continued on to preach that the whole world had been redeemed, he's got plenty of financial reasons to put on the brakes right where he is. Because you see, through the mid and late 90s was when I was preaching a mix of law and grace. And the Word of Faith movement was exploding because the Word of Faith movement had no grace in it whatsoever, did it, James? We had no grace in there whatsoever. And so when I started coming and offering Word of Faith folks a little bit of grace, it was like bringing people out from under a submerged pool. Or being submerged in a pool. And man, people started flocking out. We couldn't, every meeting that I had, there wasn't a vacant seat. They put people in classrooms with TVs in the classrooms so they could watch from there. We literally had almost every meeting I had during that time, a short year period, when I was doing exactly what Joseph Prince is doing now. We had traffic cops. Parking was, there was never enough parking, no matter what size the building.
People come to hear bad news more than good, eh?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and that was good news, though, for the Word of Faith folks and for the evangelical church, because we didn't change any of the things that you had to do to get the blessings of God. It's just now by grace that you do it. Mm. So people found relief from the work and the performance of especially the Word of Faith movement. Now, Joseph did not move away from that. When I spoke with him on the phone, he had a church of 3,000. His church is now 15,000, and he's probably one of the most sought-after speakers in the world.
Where and located?
Singapore. Yep. And he used to call me on Sunday mornings and tell me what he had preached to see whether or not it was right. And he came up with some really good things. I learned a couple of things from him as he was learning also. But I tell you what, I don't blame him for disassociating himself from me either. I mean, I would if I was somebody else. And it's like, yeah, I'm not going to associate with that guy. Look what happens to him wherever he goes, you know. So I understand why. I just don't understand the integrity or the lack of integrity in doing so. Plenty of reason to do it. But folks, I tell you what, you know, people that know me, the issue of integrity for me is it's at the top of the rung, and I have to do things where that I know my integrity is held intact, and I cannot say I didn't when I did. I can't say I will when I won't. Now I may tell you I will, and then I can't, but I'll come back and tell you I can't. But you see, integrity is such a powerful part of our communication of God to God. The reason we get all messed up with each other is because we're not honest with each other. If we took one thing, and that is that we just chose to be honest about ourselves with each other, Lord Jesus, you talk about relationships. Goodness gracious. But you know why we're not honest with each other? Because of fear of rejection. That's why we're not honest with each other. And if you think you're going to turn right around and just start being honest with folks. Now, and let me say this also. There are things about me that I'm not honest with. Let me say it this way. That I'm not open with everybody about. But you really do need to have people in your life that know you through and through. And those relationships are few and far between because there's not a whole lot of people you can trust with your innermost thoughts and the things that are going on and not judge you in the process. When I think one of the things... I've come to a point where I can hear somebody out without judging them. Now, I don't take credit for that. That's not a part of my character. I think that's a part of gospel influence. Because the thing of it is that I know that everything that another human being is, no matter how repugnant I find it, I have the potential of being the same thing. Because I'm human. Just for that reason, I have the ability to do the as much as I watch Oprah do good, and as much as I watch Extreme Makeovers, Home Edition, which I love and I cry at every time. I know me. I know what I do. I know what I do about things like that, and I know my involvement. When we had funds, goodness, we gave a home away. We gave away a $30,000 car back in the 80s, and we kept the old car and gave it to somebody else in town that had just wrecked their car and they couldn't get to their job. But see, I've lived all of this stuff out, and these are not things that we just talk about. People thought I'd lost my mind when we gave away our home. We signed our home over to the church, and it wasn't because there was any kind of, there was no request for it. But may I tell you, and the issue is not whether we did or didn't do that. The issue is just integrity. It simply is just the issue of integrity. And just being honest with each other. That's why I tell you guys about my weaknesses. See? Because I want a close relationship with you. And if you don't know about my weaknesses, I cannot have reckless abandon toward our friendship. I can't trust you if I've never trusted you. And how do you trust somebody? Honey, you don't know until you give them something that it requires trust to share. But you got to be vulnerable. You know, one of the most beautiful things about being human, number one, you're already vulnerable just by the fact that you got a body and you got a brain. You're vulnerable. And you're already vulnerable. So why develop this whole psyche of trying to hide, you know, who we are, what we are, because we're all different. We're all very different.
I just want to give an example when you're saying that. I mean, I think it's an input. Probably all being in these positions, but we have a friend right now. He's a very close friend of my husband, and he's been fighting cancer for years. And he visited with us, and they have found a tumor on his brain, so of course he's been getting treatment right here, right? And in some ways he's being helped. His vision has come back, he's feeling better, headaches, whatever. But we also noticed some ways he's not good. And when he would get up to walk, it was almost like he had to balance himself. Well, my husband got in the vehicle with him. And it was scary. I mean, here he is out driving. But then you know exactly what's going to happen now. I said to him, you've got to talk to him. He's not saying anything to him.
Yeah.
Like he's afraid he will lose his relationship.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, what is wrong with us?
Yeah.
We would sooner send that guy out in the truck to kill himself and kill somebody.
And somebody else.
And be honest with
than
him.
Just to be honest.
So what is the problem there?
That's
isn't that sad?
It shows you how powerful this thing is, our fear of being rejected by others, that we'll let them die before we suffer the possibility of being rejected by them.
And him and the other guy not having the ability to be able to receive that.
Yeah.
And say, man, you're right. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not walking well. I'm just sick of them.
A little bit of ego, maybe, I guess.
Yeah.
But isn't it sad that we are at that place?
Male ego?
Yeah.
Hey, it can be female ego too, believe me.
Jesus. Anyway, I was going to try to get through the wife a little bit.
Now, one of the things that we're going to go through is in this next session, which let me just...
Can I ask one more question?
Go ahead. And you're not doing a lot of talking. It's me that's talking all the time.
When you talked about regarding marriage, of course we were all one before.
Right.
What do you do then with the verse, and they shall no more be two but one?
That's a revelation about Christ in the church. That's what Paul said when he was talking about marriage. He said, "You know, but you've got to understand that this is all of it's about Christ in the church." So, and we understand that oneness was accomplished at the cross. When you try to equate that when two people get married, they become one, you've got some great logistical and will and different personality problems that begins to introduce into the marriage. Because you see, along with being one, you're not just one, but you're one where the husband is the head and the wife submits. And so those things lead, when you place those things which are really, marriage was a scriptural allegory that was designed to help us understand relationship between God and man. Doesn't strike anything to undermine a person's choice to mate for life with someone. In fact, I think it should enhance it actually, because see, it frees you from the bondage of those things, of we're one, so I don't get a say so, or so many of these things. And let me tell you, of course, it has been women who've suffered the most under those marriage restrictions and requirements, and. So, yeah, I still believe that even though he said that the reason he said that was to show us that had already been accomplished at the cross, that was what this whole marriage thing was all about. Let me read to you this. I think it's really, really interesting. We may touch on it tonight, we may not. I was thinking, what does it do when we understand these mysteries? What does this do? And I probably will cover this again, but we're just sitting around talking. I think it's a good thing. Let's see. Chapter 2. If I can find it. Oh, yes, here it is. Chapter 2. So what happens? See, remember last night we were talking about the impact that this gospel has, and it's kind of like clearing out RAM space and clearing out preconceived notions and ideas, and you actually begin to think differently about yourself and about others. And this is what Paul said. For I would that you knew what great conflict I have for you and for them at Laodicea, and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh, that your hearts may be comforted, number one, being knit together in love, number two, and unto all riches of the fullness of assurance of understanding. Wow. Full assurance of understanding to the acknowledgement of the mystery of God and the Father and of Christ, in whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So why are we teaching the mystery of the gospel? There is a motive. There is a result. What is the result of coming to these clues? And you guys can tell me if you've experienced this or not. According to Paul, these are some of the heart effects of understanding these mysteries. Number one, you're comforted. Anybody here not comforted by the things that you heard last night? Isn't that an incredible comfort? And this is what we've been talking about today, being knit together in love. Because, see, we're not basing our value in each other based on our weaknesses or our strengths. We're basing our value in Christ. So it tears down a whole lot of laws, or a whole lot of walls. Being knit together in love, and unto all the riches of full assurance. There is a richness to having a full assurance about this mystery of the gospel. There is an absolute wealth. You feel wealthy. You can be broke as a church mouse and still feel absolutely wealthy because of the what you understand. And I mean, you walk around a grocery store and you just feel like, my gosh, I feel so privileged to even understand this at all. I can't imagine. And then, of course, people want to get into, you know, why, who understands it and who don't, and I don't know. The only thing I know is that we've got an opportunity to try to get other people to understand it. And I can tell you with absolute confidence that those who have understood it have come into much, much better existence on planet Earth. There's just no doubt about it. So I think in the long run, see, when I hear these things that are going on in Kenya, and thank you guys for supporting what Mike Williams Ministry does. You guys know my heart. Goodness gracious. I'll be going into retirement this year. And now what that is going to mean, now I'm still coming back. What that means is a change for the ministry. Because I have to stop drawing from the ministry the amount that I get from my Social Security check, which is going to save the ministry that much money per month. And my salary will drop from what's coming into the ministry or what comes from the ministry to me. And my salary, when it's been there for the last many years, has been $40,000. Has been my peak salary, and in that, I not only take care of myself, but also take care of Hazel. Hazel is and always will be a part of my life. I do not feel less committed nor obligated to take care of Hazel after the divorce than I did before the divorce, because our divorce had nothing to do with us not loving and caring for each other. Our divorce had to do with other things. And because of that, and I mean, we've gotten so close, you just wouldn't believe. This is so crazy. I mean, we actually can acknowledge that we love each other even more, or at least are able to express it since the divorce. And we just seem to get closer and closer over the years. And we are so defensive and protective of each other. And it's, you know, and we've had these talks, you know, well, what's going to happen when I'm down and can't do, or you're down and you can't do? And we've already got it planned. Whatever I do, I'm going to take care of Hazel. And whatever she's doing, she's coming to take care of me, because we don't trust anybody else right now to do it. Because I think we got some people that would just soon see us go on anyway. So, but we have such a great confidence in each other. And so the ministry is going to be gaining from my retirement. And but what you guys do, folks, I tell you what, goodness gracious, if somebody would have told me that we would be standing in the position that we are, in the places in the world that we are right now, any time before now, I just would not have been able to conceive it. And has it sunk in that we are going live with radio programs on a Muslim-owned and operated radio station in July in Kenya and Somalia? In July, we are going on air, live, on a Catholic-owned and operated radio station, also taking in Kenya and some of the other border surrounding countries. And I don't know anybody that's doing that, even with a false gospel. who has that opportunity laying in their hands? Who has that? I don't know. You guys have that opportunity laying right in your hands. And because this is, as you guys know, I've always operated this Mike Williams Ministries. It's been us. I mean, you know, you can ask Bernice and Leslie how this has been operated all of these years. And it's always been, and James also, this has always been a group effort. And I know that you guys are as much responsible for what's happening out there as I am. I may be the spokesman, but you know, it's very rarely the spokesman for anything that's actually causing the things to happen. So thank you so much for everything that you do. Goodness gracious. My heart is in a lot of places, but right now it is so in Northern Africa, I hardly know what to do with myself. No, I haven't, and I probably am not going either. My heart's there. I'll send you. Hear my Lord, send Neil. One of the reasons for that is not only I don't want to travel. I'm content in Houston, Texas. I just don't have the desire to do those things. I come here with you guys, and thank goodness you understand my panic attacks. You understand my hesitancy in getting up in front of people. You deal with it. I know most of you can't see it, but at least I'm able to be honest with you guys about it. And that's part of the reason that it makes it easy for me to come in here in front of you guys and do this, is because I can be completely open and honest with you that I've got this major problem. And that major problem stands right between me and the thing that I really love to do, and that is to stand up and share the gospel. But don't be surprised that the greatest gift or talent that you might have might be just on the other side of the greatest fear that you have also. So don't be stopped by the things that you fear. Because if there is something there that is in your heart to do, but you're stopping because of a fear, let me tell you something, you just may have found the greatest talent that you'd ever have, especially by experience, if it's accompanied by something that you would just absolutely dread to be involved in. So life is very amazing to me. And it is not the thing as to whether we suffer loss or gain. That's not the issue for me. The issue for me is to experience it and see what it's like and to go through it. without a shadow of a doubt, as we sit right here in this small gathering, there's every one of us is going to, some one of us is going to at least experience the death of someone close to us between now and the next time we get together. Maybe not somebody in your immediate household, could be. But you see, we have so designed a religious belief that it feels like that if we believe the right thing, it will immune us from tragedies. And that's one of the most dangerous ways of thinking that a person can possibly fall into. Because nothing you believe immunes you from tragedy. Nothing. And I know when I say that, people feel like I'm pulling the rug out from under them. But let me tell you something. Once the rug's gone, you know what you got? A solid floor. There ain't no rug to be pulled out from under you anymore. You're standing on solid ground. You're not wondering what's under there. You're standing on the good stuff now. So, and I realize that when you teach something that I don't have a thing to tell you what to do to get God to reward you at all. I don't have one thing to say about that whatsoever because I don't believe that it even exists. And I think most of you are so far ahead of me anyway, you've already tried it and you know it doesn't exist. And the most dangerous thing that can possibly happen is that you start praying about something and then it actually turn out good. It's a real dangerous thing to happen. Because you see, you get addicted. Because the fact is, just as many good things happen to people that don't pray as happens to people who do pray, and vice versa. Of all of that. I was watching an interview, and you guys are probably going to think I'm really weird when I share this with you, but you already think it anyway. So, I was watching Seth MacFarlane. How many of you know who Seth MacFarlane is? I knew you'd know who Seth MacFarlane was. Seth MacFarlane is a creator of Family Guy. Has anybody here seen Family Guy? All right. Don't know Brian, and oh my goodness, Jesus. Brian the dog, and he's got more personality than any human being you've ever seen. But anyway, he created Family Guy, and he is an avowed atheist. And back in September of 2011, he had the greatest break that he had with his production, and now, goodness, he's got a big movie coming out, 1,000 Ways to Die in the Old West. It's comedy. I can't wait to see it. I've seen the previews. Most comedies don't get to me, but my gosh, when you go back through all the ways you've seen in westerns, especially somebody my age, it's how they've died and they do a spoof on it all the way through. It's people dying, and it's all comedy. I can't wait. I think it's just going to be the best movie I've ever seen. But Seth MacFarlane is an avowed atheist. And he got this big break, and he had to be up in the Northeast. And so he scheduled a flight back home on 9/11. He had to go down to Boston to catch a flight back to L.A. And when he got back to, when he got down to Boston, and he walked up to the gate agent to hand her his boarding pass, she said, "I am sorry, Mr. MacFarlane, they just closed the door." Well, anybody that's flown knows what "just closed the door" means. You ain't getting on. And you can beg, you can cry, you can scream, you can explain why, but when that door closes, the door's closed, and you ain't getting on. Well, Flight 11 is one of the planes from the from 9/11 that crashed, and everyone was used as a bomb, and everyone on it died. I was thoroughly impressed and delighted that that experience did not make a believer in God out of Seth MacFarlane. Because had that experience made him a believer, he would have been in bondage for the rest of his life to this circumstantial spirituality. Then he would have had to try to figure out why did God save him. You know, last time I was here, I told you guys I was waiting because CNN was coming out with this documentary on soul survivors and people who had survived. Because I've used the girl in the plane crash in Chicago who was a little baby that survived. I've used her for 30 years in my teachings. And that was the point, one of my points where I shook my head and I said, wait. And they were saying that she was a miracle and that God must have really have a plan for her. You know that they went through all of these soul survivors from these major disasters and virtually all of them are mental and emotional wrecks because they have felt such pressure to be special that they are in tears still over the fact that they survived. Because everybody in the world says, wow, God saved you out of 300 people off of this flight, so you have a great future and a great plan from God. And they're still trying just to get through the day like everybody else is, just like you do, but with a thing hanging over their head that they're supposed to be something much more, even way more than you think you should be something much more on an hour-by-hour basis because they survived. Therefore, God must have something great for you. Seth MacFarlane got past that. He did not allow that to convert him to believing in God. If Seth MacFarlane becomes a believer in God, I hope it's because of the gospel, not because of external, superficial spirituality. And let me tell you something. This is being recorded, I would rather see Seth MacFarlane remain an atheist than to become a Christian or any other religion on the face of the earth. I find only two healthy ways to think for human beings. Atheism or the gospel. I only find two. And it's taken me a long time in sorting these things out. I do not find anything else. If you show me something that keeps people from falling into cause and effect religion, and you know the universe is doing this and karma's doing that, and all of that connected to a response that there's a spiritual thing going on that is watching you and responding in some way to your actions and will either reward you or rebuff you in some way, you're going to get it back. Now, let me tell you something. That's been proven to not be true. There's people who have done heinous things. Now, in Buddhism, of course, they got that all worked out because the people who do heinous things and they get by with it and they go to their grave and then we found out what they did. It's like, oh, they'll get it in the next one, you know. They get to come back as a bug and get squashed on a windshield, you know. The many other things. But why go through those calisthenics? Folks, you have life. People ask me, Mike Williams, what is life all about? It's here to use. Use it up. You got a brain. You got legs. I just met a new friend down in Houston. He's as tall as I am, and goodness gracious, he's a big dude. And I have never heard this man, now he works like 18-hour days, never heard him complain once. Never heard him complain. Not one single complaint have I heard come out of his mouth. And his truck broke down. He has to drive from one job to the other. Gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to his first job. Works till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He's got 3 kids. And then gets off of that job. And then at 5 o'clock goes to work for another 8-hour shift after that. And then his car broke down. So you know what he did? He just stays at the first job from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock. He stays there until he's ready to go. And do you know what comes out of his mouth? He said, Michael, he says, there are men that don't even have legs to walk around from between 2 and 5 o'clock. I was blown away. I said, you got to be kidding me. I'd be bitching and complaining all over the place that I was stuck in that situation. And folks, there's something so solid. Use up your life. Use up. You've got breath and energy and God in you. Don't settle for settling for. Maybe you're doing what you want to do. And that's full of contentment. Then great. I'm not telling you got to be an Oprah Winfrey to be happy. Dear Lord, the thing of it is that you've got to be content within yourself. But whatever you do, use up the breath you got. Use up the energy you've got. Use up the mobility that you have. Because one of these days, you ain't going to have it. By whatever means. Whether it's absolutely final and this body's put in the ground or cremated, whatever you've chosen to do. But folks, the only thing I know for sure, we can talk about the next life and the Mormons are trying to get a planet to rule over and in the next life. That's fine. Go to your planet and have, rule over whatever. Wouldn't that have been horrible while the time that they had Pluto as a planet and the Mormon would have got that and all of a sudden it's not a planet no more. Oh boy, I got gypped. You sent me to planet Pluto and I'm ruling over something that's not even a planet anymore. But now I you can tell by my speaking facetiously about it, I think it's a bunch of bull. But use up what you got here. I don't know what's going to be like on the other side. I know it can't be bad. I know that in God it has to be good. I know after the work of the cross. But folks, you have no guarantee. You don't know that. Well, I believe we come back again. You can believe it all you want, but you don't know it. What you know can only be known in the context of time and space. That's the only thing you can know.
It's interesting that we don't know that, isn't it?
It is interesting we don't know that. And the only thing that we can do is be at peace with the fact we don't know it. We don't know it. We find such trouble with not knowing it, we are willing to buy into anybody's story about, I died and went to heaven, went to hell. I spent time in purgatory. And man, it's like, man, did you read this guy's story? Did you see what he said? It's like none of it moves me one way or the other. Now, I'm not going to try to prove him wrong. It's irrelevant to me. But I am very aware that the vast majority of my life was consumed with depression and guilt and shame and self-loathing and mental institutions and shock treatments and lockup wards and every ounce of it came from my Christian doctrine. You say, how do you know that? Well, I can only tell you that all of that's gone after I got rid of my Christian doctrine. I tried to get rid of everything else, and all I did is become a fake and a phony. Folks, live out of yourself. You're like this planet. All the water that's on the surface came from within. I don't know why that excites me so much, I'm telling you. All this planet has came from inside of it. Oh my gosh. And when you see this magnificent God who has created all things and has done it in this incredible fractal way, to where that everything is representative, the big is the representative of the small is representative of the large. It really is.
God within.
I think it is. And that's what Paul said. Nature itself would teach it. And the more we learn about the very nature, the more we see, wow, it is a perfect type and shadow of the way it is with us. Not only accept that all that God is within, except that every person that you look at has got the same thing. It's going to be a totally different expression. And let me tell you something, when you're hooked on religion, you're not going to be a nice person. So don't say, well, now, look, see, I can tell you one thing. I didn't see God in them. Well, there may be a reason for that. There's a new movie out. It's a horrible movie. I won't go see it, but I got tickled watching the previews. There's this guy, I don't know what the name of the movie is, but it's one of those psycho movies. There's this guy that does, he's a motivational speaker. Turn that frown upside down. Da, 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 yeah, yeah, you don't have no problems. Yeah, you know, all you need's a plan. You da, blah, 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 blah. Well, there happens to be this guy who's listened to him for all these years, and you know, the guy was molested and beaten and raped and poverty and things beyond what this guy's ever thought about going through. And so he winds up getting the guy to where he's answering questions and engaging him, but it turns really psycho, and he winds up with the guy tied up in his basement. And he's got gags and restraints and torturing him and all of this stuff, standing back saying, turn that frown upside down. I thought it was a brilliant theme for a movie. As sick as my mind is, I thought it was just a brilliant theme for a movie. And they're over there, oh, turn that frown upside down. You don't have any problems. You just need a positive attitude. That's what's wrong with you. And so I probably just did the best advertisement for that movie they've ever had. I cannot tell you the name of it. So, you know, guys, everybody that is here, we all enjoy a really wonderful relationship, and I want you to know that I treasure that. There's some of you that I've known for more than 20 years, and there's some of you that I've just met, our friends here. And but let's treasure that, not just with me, but with each other and with people that you meet when you walk into grocery stores and when you're going about your day. Stop and acknowledge, I want to see what God looks like in this person. And I'm telling you, start looking at it and you will see it. You will see it. Engage, engage, engage. Do you know that most of these people that are doing these horrid, dastardly mass shootings and everything, do you know the one common thing that I've found amongst them? Nobody engages them at all. They are so isolated. They are so alone. Now that does not believe. Let me tell you something, folks. When you go in and kill kids, I personally would like to be the person there to execute my own judgment upon that person. I'm not that enlightened or elevated, if you will. But we can't overlook the facts of the things that come out of these things. That these people have no one who speaks well of them, no one who engages them. And boy, I tell you what, if you don't have another human being engaging the God that is within you, the mind can really warp. It can really, really warp and distort. And it's like a little kid. They're going to get attention some way. And I know that's pretty extreme. That's horribly extreme. And anyone who does such a thing, that, you know, has to face the penalty. Most of them kill themselves anyway. But we've got to stop and start listening and engaging. And just the fact that we engage, let it be a process that you go through to where that you're discovering God in other people. And you are going to be so delighted. I'm telling you, it is such a delightful thing. Until I started doing that, I realized that after all this teaching of all these years, I am an extremely judgmental person. Because I judge according to outside. I, you know, look at somebody and I say, well, you know, hey, yeah. And come to all kinds of assessments of them based on how they look or what they drive or where they live. And let me tell you something, that is just as ungodly as anything that could possibly be. But the only way you're going to get past it, the only way I'm going to get past it, is to push yourself out of your comfort zone and engage people. Engage people where they are. Even the ones that their face looks like, leave me alone. Because you know that's the one thing that people say about me, like when I'm at the gym or out and about, the reason people say that they don't approach me is because I look unapproachable. Now, I don't get it. I'm sweet and charming and kind and good-looking and all of these things. I guess I'm just too nice to approach them. But you don't know what your face says, number one. Please don't ever think that the way you feel shows up on your face, because that's not true. That's the most shocking thing to me to find out. When I felt the lowest and needed someone to hug me, someone to say I care, what showed up on my face was, leave me alone, and if you don't, I'm going to punch you in the face. Now, I don't know why translation from emotions to face don't work.
Especially for gravity, it changes your smile.
Yes.
To
really does. Yes, it does.
I noticed.
It gets tiring trying to keep it up. You know.
I practice, but the
time,
and it aches.
And it aches. It aches to smile. Well, it takes thousands of muscles to frown, so whatever that means. But see, I think there's something very real about this gospel, and I think it's very real to the point of experience, and to where that you get this assurance, and there's something that happens. But let it push you past the faces that you think and what you see. My new friend that I've told a couple of you about, a lot of similarities. He has three children, and both of our names are Michael. We're both 6'6", shaved head, goatee. I told him, I said, yeah, and we're both black. And he looked at me like, what? But he is a black guy. And I'm the youngest in my family. He's the youngest in his family. He has three kids. I have three kids. And it was crazy. And then he pulled out his cell phone. I said, you know, well, let's go to dinner or something. Says, this sounds like a lot of fun. And so he pulled out his cell phone. And it was exactly my cell phone and the one out of several hundred covers you get from China. He had the same one. And he fell in the floor. And he just fell out. We had a religious service right there, but so I almost did not approach him because he's a very imposing person. He's my height, and he's big fellow, and his face. He's only 41, but his face doesn't have that, you know, look on it. And he told me, you know, we got to talking about this the other day, and he told me, he says, Michael, nobody approaches me. He says, I was so shocked when you walked up and said hi, and, you know, did you have a good workout? He says, nobody does that to me. And so we talked about that as to why that happens. Always believe the best about yourself, so that you won't have hesitancy about saying something to somebody else. Because the reason you don't say things to other people or engage is because of the negative feelings you have about yourself. I'm imposing my psychology and my psychosis on everyone, but that's just the way it is. I think the gospel is very practical. It's very powerful. And I do believe it could stop war. The element that we have going on right here, expanded, extrapolated, yes, I think it could have an effect on war on this planet. And we've got all the time in the world to work on it. Because Jesus already came back, and the end of the world already took place. And now we stand in a place to where that we've got time. Let this gospel sink in. We're getting better at this all around the world. So don't get discouraged, folks. My gosh, I tell you, sometimes you have to turn on off CNN and Fox and MSNBC. You just have to turn it off because they are so compressed of the news from around the world immediately that, you know, just a few years ago, you only got that news once a week or something. Now you get all of it every day and the nitty-gritty detail all day long. And it seems worse, but the fact of it is, it's not.
We haven't had TV for a month already, and it's amazing the transition that you go through.
Really?
In your day.
Yeah.
In your day, like, well, what do you do? You know, like you usually just kind of gravitate to the TV in the evening.
Yes.
You know, and don't do that anymore. Now, oh, okay. Find a book to read, or
yeah.
We'll do something in the yard, or
play,
you know. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. What an experience! It's a first world problem.
Yes. You know, we live in a generation where that we have way too much information coming at us, and you need to stay in control of that information. I think it's not that you shouldn't be informed. But you really should remain in control of the information that comes to you. Because, man, I'm telling you what, it can be sensory overload, and you'll forget who you are and they are and be judging everybody on the planet before it's over with. All right? I had a wonderful time this morning. Hope you did too.
7 o'clock?
7 o'clock tonight? Yes.
Be here early at 6:30 for a seat?
Yeah, because, hey, you know, we could run out of seats. You better get here. Love you guys. Don't forget to give us your money.
Hello? Good job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think I'm up in the
place.
Dining
up. Uh-oh.